Hello and welcome back to AEC Perspectives. I'm your host, Brian Nickel, Chief Strategy Officer at RSNH. And today I am excited to be joined by RSNH's Vice President, Rich Stump, one of our leaders in our federal market. Rich serves as the Vice President for RSNH. As part of RSNH's team in our federal market, he manages indefinite delivery and indefinite quantity contracts, provides strategic client management, and collaborates with the business development team to identify and capitalize on pursuits and growth opportunities in the market. For more than 25 years, Rich has provided architecture and engineering design services to the U.S. Department of Defense, federal government agencies, and commercial partners. His international project and program experience includes 39 countries across six continents, focusing on Japan, Guam, Korea, Southwest Asia, the United Kingdom, and the Caribbean Commonwealth nations. Rich is a fellow in the Society of American Military Engineers, former Regional Vice President of the SAME Pacific Region. His global experience includes working with the International Federation of Consulting Engineers, where he founded FIDIC's Young Professional Forum and serves as its Integrity Management Committee. Rich, it's great to have you on AEC Perspectives. Let's dive right into this episode as part of our second season and gain a perspective from you, Rich, on your federal project work and all things SAME and RSNH and federal. Great to have you.
Great. Brian, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm going to just jump right in, as I usually do on these podcasts, and just throw out a little interesting question. We've had some opportunity to talk, and you shared with me your specialty around military design charrettes. In fact, you have an upcoming presentation at the 10th Annual SAME SMPS Industry Day. Can you share some details about the presentation and your experience with charrettes?
Absolutely. So the presentation that's coming up on 17 April in St. Louis is related to the SAME St. Louis Post. This is an annual event. And one of the things that will happen is I'm going to be making actually the second iteration of a presentation that I made at the Small Business Conference for SAME back in November. And this was in San Antonio. So it's a presentation called Seven Words You Can't Say in a Design Charrette. Now, those of you who are listening who have maybe been around the block a little bit might remember a comedian by the name of George Carlin. And he had a very famous comedy routine, which ended up in an FCC, Federal Communications Commission lawsuit regarding what can and can't be said on television or over that type of media. So George had a rather thoughtful comedian that he is, with a colorful tongue, has had seven words that you can't say on television, and you still can't say them on television. So we won't repeat them here today. And if you want to see if I'm going to repeat them during that presentation, you'll want to go to St. Louis and find out. But really, it's kind of a way to tee up the importance of the military design charrette. So one of the things that happens when we're working on architect engineer designs for, our DoD service agencies is generally at the beginning of a design project or beginning of a planning activity or anything related to providing professional services, we want a level set. We want to have a design workshop or, the nomenclature that the military likes to use is a charrette. And the intent there is to validate requirements, to understand what the stakeholders need, and to define what mission success is going to look like with regard to whatever activity is being executed, whether it's a planning activity, a design of a building, design of, say, a military installation, whatever the scope may be. And what I've developed an expertise in over the years is acting as that facilitator, basically being the responsible party who puts on a project hat and acts as a neutral party with the design team, with the agency that's looking to execute the project, and with the stakeholders and end users, to make sure that they get what they need, to make sure that what gets constructed meets the mission, that provides a complete and usable facility or complete and usable piece of infrastructure, whatever the end state is, and basically helps support the warfighter, support their families, make sure that they can project power, get things done, and at the end of the day, bring everybody home safely.
That's an amazing sort of process that you've been through throughout your 25-year career, and you've perfected this. Can you, and I know this is a family program, an industry program, so we won't say George Carlin's seven words, and you're going to be talking about those seven words in this presentation. You're going to lay out the case for how you go about the design charrettes and why it's so impactful. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Like, what's the end game that you want to get to as you conduct the charrette?
So there's a number of things that you want to try to do as when you're facilitating an activity with whether it's 5 or 50 or 150 stakeholders. The first thing is you want to try to do at the beginning is level set. And I've conceived of just the whole delivery process of being a facilitator really consisting of three components. One is that, you're a pilot. Your job is to get the charrette started off right, let others do the things that they do best during the charrette, but then you've got to land it. You've got to bookend a solid delivery at the beginning and a solid delivery at the end so that people walk away with the correct takeaways, they walk away understanding what success looked like, and that there's a clear path forward for the design team to move to the next activity and to deliver the project. So you're a pilot. Second thing that you're doing is you're a conductor. I mean, if you think about an orchestra, for example, by analogy, somebody has to make sure that all of the different pieces in the orchestra get their opportunity to shine, that they understand how to work together cohesively to put together a good piece of music. In this case, the charrette is that piece of music, and everybody's got a role. Everybody needs to have their, make their participation, their contributions, so that you get to the end of the activity and everybody says, okay, that time was well spent. It was harmonious and collaborative and successful. And then the third thing, going back to one of my favorite commercials of all time, which was the Super Bowl in 2000. This is a commercial from EDS, is cat herding. So a good facilitator is a cat herder. You have all these people with all these different ideas and all these different thoughts about what success looks like, what's in it for them, what's important to them. And you only have so much time to do it to keep everybody focused and push them all in the right direction. So again, at the end of the day, you've been successful. You've defined the requirements. The things that are not requirements are nice to haves are appropriately tracked and dealt with either in the session or later on. But there's like those three big hats that a really solid facilitator wears. You're a pilot, you are a conductor, and you're a catter.
Well, I relate to the pilot and the conductor, but now I understand the cat herding because you have all these different stakeholders. You've got the agency itself and its mission, but you want to make sure everything comes together. And oftentimes there are competing interests in these kinds of projects, and there's certainly an outcome everybody wants to get to. So having a strong pilot, a great conductor, and that very important cat herder sounds like the recipe for success. How many of these have you done throughout your career?
I started really getting involved in doing them back in 2010. So what are we, 14 years after that? I've probably done 70, 75 of them since then. I do about 6 to 8 a year. What I'm finding is the recipe that I'm using, say for a design charrette, you can very easily apply to a design review workshop. You can apply to a risk management session. You can apply it to any type of activity where you're bringing together stakeholders and you're bringing together people who are working towards a common goal. So while it works, you know, extremely well for the nuance of a military design charrette and working with the different people who will show up at that, you can really take these the tools that I will talk about at that presentation and that I've talked about at the SBC presentation, and you can riff them for just about any design activity or planning activity where somebody's got to take on those three hats and help move a group of people towards a successful outcome.
Well, I'm excited for your presentation. I encourage our listeners to get to St. Louis on the 17th of April and hear what you have to say. Your expertise in this area has not only helped many agencies, but it's facilitated a whole host of projects. As you said, projects that span all kinds of different aspects. You know, at RSNH, our teams work on projects all across federal agencies, namely in the Department of Defense. And that allows us to work on projects of strategic military importance and implication. How does that drive you and your team for the work that you do? So if you're thinking about like how important those projects are, the implications that are in many cases life and death, and in other cases of strategic importance to maintain our position of strength, does that have an impact on you individually and then on your team? And can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I did very early in my career is I served in the Air Force as an Air Force Civil Engineering Officer. And I went through ROTC during my undergraduate education at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, went on active duty. And during that time, I had the opportunity to do a variety of things. I was on active duty for 5 years, stationed in San Antonio, Texas. That was my first duty assignment. Went out to Saudi Arabia, and I was at Eskon Village about 6 months after Khobar Towers, if you remember. That was really one of the very first significant terrorist attacks against American forces. You know, one of the really first big ones would be in the Marine barracks in Lebanon. I think that was 82, if I remember correctly. So this was Khobar Towers was 96. So I was out in Eskon in 97, and the military was still trying to figure out how to spell force protection, and keeping troops safe was a really big deal and continues to be a big deal to this day. And then just kind of going back to some of the things I got an opportunity to do on active duty, it was in a unit called Red Horse, which is basically a rapid deployable combat engineering unit that went and built things specifically to support Air Force, projection of power. And as part of that, I had the opportunity to go to Central America after Hurricane Mitch kind of leveled four countries. It hit Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. And my unit got deployed down there to go help put things back together. And it was a military operation other than war. So we weren't, going and fighting or securing things. But I can tell you from a professional and personal fulfillment perspective, to be able to go to a place that had been heavily damaged and, people had lost a lot of things that were really important to their livelihoods. And we were able to go back in and rebuild roads. And we built a cable stayed bridge across a river that allowed people to get again from one side of the river to the other because the bridge had gotten washed out by the hurricane. That was incredibly fulfilling and probably still remains to me to be the most important thing that from a fulfillment perspective that I've done in my career. So going forward to today, in terms of things I'm doing at RSNH, working with the Naval Facilities Engineering Command, work with the Army Corps of Engineers, working with the Air Force Civil Engineer Center and some of our Air National Guard units. I'm very, very passionate about national security. I'm very, very passionate about national defense. Another thing that I had the opportunity to do in my career is I lived out in Guam for 6 years. So I was involved early on in the Marine Corps buildup on Guam, where we were as part of the Defense Posture Realignment Initiative. The forces in the Pacific are being reallocated and moved around in order to provide a counterweight to some of the bad actors in that part of the world. So I saw a lot of things in some of the infancy of programs that are well underway and have been underway for many years. And when you see things that happen by proxy in certain parts of the world, it really informs your worldview that even a small project, or what may seemingly be a small project that we're working on at a base in the U.S., can have, you know, very serious and very important geopolitical considerations. Again, just depending on how our missions and how national security is considered, and you know, those are our leaders in Congress and in the military are working with our coalition partners and, you know, just keeping people safe around the world. So it's something that is very near and dear to my heart, and is something that I consider, you know, very, very important in terms of just kind of how I manage myself and how I work with the teams that we have and the partners that we have in delivering services and solutions to the military.
Well, I appreciate that worldview. And as I looked at your experience around six continents, 39 countries all across the world, that not only helps inform you through your design charrettes, but it also helps inform you as you implement projects, that no matter where those projects are located, they have a connection to the entire planet. And I think that is something that's unique in the kind of work that you do and that our teams do at RSNH around supporting Department of Defense and the federal projects that weave themselves throughout that force protection, the geopolitical considerations that you mentioned. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was what makes working for federal agencies different than other public sector clients? So you've kind of laid that foundation. Mm-hmm. Talk about the differences.
One of the things that we have in the United States that no other architectural engineering community in the world has is something called the Brooks Act. And the Brooks Act is a federal law that says that all architectural engineering services that are procured by a U.S. government agency have to be procured strictly on technical qualifications first and cost second. So in a lot of the work that I've done in other parts of the world, you know, for non-federal customers, there's always a cost component. And in, you know, dealing with colleagues in other countries, and I tell them about the fact that we have this Brooks Act, they're just kind of stunned because they're competing on cost. It's a very different driver when you can compete to win work based on your ability to deliver and the qualifications of your team versus can you be the cheapest solution?
Exactly.
And given the fact that architects and engineers have a, you know, they have a responsibility for the health and safety and welfare of the public, to have to compete on price is,
you solely, know, solely,
is a problem.
Right? Yeah. And when you're competing on price and that's it, without regard to your technical qualifications, it turns into a different kind of project. But when you approach the project technically, from experience, from the kinds of things that make the project the best it can be, that's altogether a different factor. And certainly cost is a component, but it doesn't drive out the pure technical aspect. Do you pride yourself around that, bringing those strong technical qualifications and skills and experience to your clients? And
oh, absolutely.
How do you do that? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, so kind of, you know, kind of going back to the previous question, then I'll come back to this question. So working, you know, again, working for federal agencies, the Brooks Act and the fact that we get to compete on technical quals is really important. And then when you think about, you know, again, a lot of what I do is working for DoD agencies. And then I've, you know, been increasingly involved in supporting some of the Air National Guard units, which is again, rolls up to the Department of Defense. But there are people who are not full-time active duty military personnel. They, you know, are invested in the communities where they serve. So that takes that federal component and brings it local in terms of, again, they're part of our ability to provide security for Americans and for the U.S. government. And they're a key component of that. But we're, you know, working for the federal government is working for the DoD. One of the things that is important to think about I got my education as an architect in school. It's not always the flashy high-end architecture that a lot of people think that, you know, oh, gee, I'd really like to be able to design, you know, super tall buildings or some, you know, just some really kind of cutting edge architecture. But really where the creativity comes into these types of projects is because of the constraints that you have to work within. And I think if you look at really talented architects and engineers over the years, the more constraints you have, and oftentimes the higher quality solution you're going to come up with. So the challenge is, okay, you've got a very constrained set of requirements that you have to work within, and how do we deliver based on the needs of the warfighter, the needs of the warfighter's families? How do you deliver based on the what's called the Unified Facility Criteria, these UFCs, which drive military design, in addition to the codes that we have to follow for anything in the built environment?
So you're looking at pretty complex work. I mean, this is, you've got multiple different aspects. You also have a whole host of stakeholders, as you mentioned earlier. Talk about how the role of interdisciplinary teamwork plays in that very complex work.
Well, it's absolutely critical. I mean, buildings and infrastructure are getting more and more complicated every year. So, and one of the things that, you know, I think everybody that's, you know, listening, if you're listening to this conversation, you know, now we have AI, that genie's out of the bottle. That complicates things. We have cybersecurity. We have issues where technology has brought us some wonderful things that allow us to deliver solutions faster and more effectively. At the same time, they've also created all kinds of security challenges and risks. And now we have to safeguard our data. We have to make sure that we're being very mindful and thoughtful of how information is moved around and stored and secured and processed. And then, of course, the facilities and the infrastructure we're designing have to take that into account. So if you don't have a good team that is, you know, really working together and understands the importance of the mission, you can't just dial in these types of projects. If you do, you're probably going to end up not getting invited back because they have very significant, you know, potentially significant downstream considerations for doing something that's really important. We're not designing a parking lot for Walmart. You know, we're not designing a road to help somebody get to the mall 5 minutes faster. I mean, yes, those pieces of infrastructure are important to be sure. When you are given the responsibility to work for the U.S. government, and you're given the responsibility to work for people that have, you know, taken an oath to protect the country, you know, there's an additional level of thoughtfulness and responsibility that you need to bring to the table every day. And, you know, that type of gravitas, I think, helps drive just the decisions that the teams that I get to work with in terms of the solutions we come up with.
Well, and the other aspect of it, so you layer on these very complex and critical implications of what the design does, what it means, how cybersecurity may play into it, how physical security may play into it, how it looks in the built environment, all of these things, and then the ability to advance the mission of the particular federal agency. Now, all of those are Absolutely critical. The next thing that gets put in the mix is resiliency and sustainability. And so it has to be a resilient building. It has to be a resilient facility. And sustainability and resiliency factors, as you know, are increasingly complex, not only for remodels of existing environments, but for those new builds that are critical that need to last a long time. How do you look at the resiliency and sustainability factors and put that into the project work that you do?
Well, certainly there are a series of executive orders that drive baseline performance requirements for any type of a military project, what, facilities or otherwise. And then certainly if you're working on a project in another location, like say, for example, I had the opportunity to participate in an SAME workshop over in Europe, in Naples, Italy. And we were talking about the host nation considerations, because if we're going to design a project in Italy, guess what? Not only do we have to follow international building codes, not only do we have to follow the US building codes and criteria, because guess what? These buildings are being inhabited by US personnel. We also have to involve the Unified Facilities Criteria, which are the military design requirements. Oh, and by the way, now we have to follow the Italian requirements, the EU requirements. So things can very, very quickly become incredibly complicated. So you need a local partner who understands how to work with the U.S. military and how to work with firms who support the U.S. military. Resiliency and sustainability is always going to be a key component of a project. Buildings, contribute significantly to greenhouse gases in the world. There's a lot of embodied carbon in just the buildings that are being delivered on and historically. And then, of course, we've got all this infrastructure and these buildings and facilities that are getting older. There's not enough money to maintain all of them. So installations are constantly having to make decisions with what do they really need to get the mission done? What buildings do we need to retire? I mean, we've worked on some projects recently. There was a military hangar that we had the opportunity to do some planning studies on about a year and a half or so ago down in Corpus Christi. The hangar was built in 1941, and it had been, gone through various stages of ability to function and non-function and being condemned and then being restored. And then finally, this 82-year-old hangar is like, yeah, we need a new one. I mean, so then you've got all these issues related to, okay, well, guess what? Back in the 1940s, asbestos was a good thing, or, maybe we put lead-based paint in there. And, okay, now we have, PFAS and PFOS, and there might have been a discharge. So there's all these environmental considerations, all these health-based considerations, in addition to the fact that you've got a building that is not as efficient and as effective as it could be, not just for sustainability and resilience, but even for meeting the mission, for protecting the assets that are in there, because guess what? Corpus Christi is in Hurricane Alley. So yeah, in addition to designing a resilient structure, you need to make sure that we're being thoughtful and, protecting the assets from storm surge, protecting the assets from a powerful hurricane that rolls through the area and damages everything in its wake. So it's there, there's that additional level of, not only to say sophistication, but the responsibility for not just meeting a mission, but meeting a mission in a sustainable, in an environmentally sensitive way, and in a way that addresses an issue of resiliency. Because guess what? If that hangar fails, you can't protect the aircraft that are in it. You can't fight and project a mission from a building that doesn't work or is full of water or, is had a, the roof blown off of it. I mean, you look at, say, Tyndall Air Force Base, which, I think was damaged by Hurricane Michael. It was basically destroyed, and is being rebuilt. So the Air Force is looking at that as kind of like the installation of the future. And a lot of things are being constructed there with the intent that they may very well become, standard requirements.
Kind of the model, if you will. So
Correct.
you now look at our world in a different way than what it was looked at 80 years ago, for example. when you're thinking about, and so you're an architect, you have that architectural background, you have the Department of Defense and the federal agency and your service to our country. We are certainly grateful for that. You got firsthand experience around the world. You know, as you think about architects, we oftentimes think about, and we've had architects on the podcast, and we've talked about architecture perspectives, both from a building standpoint, from a creativity standpoint. We have a need for architects to, you know, as we do for engineers in our industry. And as you look at the creative aspects of architecture and design, and then you understand the mission requirements, the constraints that you may have, how do you balance that? What is the mechanism? And do you do that through charrettes? Do you do that through just your vast experience? Talk about that. And I'm really intrigued because there's so much creativity and you're such a creative individual anyway. How do you do that? And then how do you get your team to do that?
So I think, Brian, that maybe the first thing to do is to frame, well, what is a creative act? And when you think about what creativity is, really anything can be creative. And I'm gonna cite a book that I've recently read that I would highly recommend anybody who's curious pick up a copy of, which is Rick Rubin's The Creative Act. And those of you who might know who Rick Rubin is, he was an extremely successful music producer. So he worked behind the scenes and then he went out and wrote this book, which it's divided up into a series of chapters. It's, you know, you can pick it up and read for 5 to 10 minutes and then go put it down and go back to it at a later date. But I think that, you know, let's define the, I'll tell you what I consider the creative act to be. So the creative act is going to be any time that we are working to, you know, solve a challenge, solve a, you know, a problem, get, you know, with the skill sets we bring to the table. So really, even this podcast is a creative act. You and I are sitting here having a conversation. We are creating a conversation that didn't exist. And right. You're bringing questions to the table and I'm bringing some answers to the conversation, which is then spinning off new lines of inquiry and discussion. So having said that, creativity can be a wide variety of things. So let's talk about what creativity means in terms of through the lens of working for the Department of Defense. We're in the architects and engineers create, we solve problems. We look at a challenge. That's one of the reasons why I love working in this industry, because, you know, and anybody can be creative, and everybody who's a team member has the opportunity to be creative in whatever he or she does, whether it's, you know, solving some particular aspect of a building, or again, facilitating a charrette, or putting together a design package that's going to be given to a contractor to go build something. Those are all creative acts. And when you think about them as creative acts, I mean, then it's again, okay, you have these constraints that you need to work with. And we've kind of gone through some of them. You know, you've got these criteria, you've got these codes, you've got the fact that you're trying to understand what do our customers need? What do these war fighters need? What do these agencies need? And what is the right way, you know, what is an effective solution? And that's what our teams do. We solve problems. We work on behalf of these agencies who rely on our teams to solve challenges for them so they can be successful in prosecuting their mission, whatever that mission may be. It could be, you know, a child development center. So that mission is, okay, it's taking care of the children of our warfighters and their families so they don't have to worry about that their kids are being educated. They can go do their day job, which is to, you know, something related to national defense and national security. Or maybe we're working for special operations forces and we're providing them with a facility that allows them to plan and execute their missions, or we're providing them with a training complex. I mean, there's the wide variety of projects I've had the chance to be associated with in my career is stunning when I sit and think about it.
That's amazing, because what it does is it re- what you've just done is you've painted this not only the creative picture and the creative act that has to happen, but the diversity of what you need to bring in order to accomplish a particular mission, a particular project, a particular building. And that to me is, you know, as a, we sort of come full circle here, as we've talked about, how do we get everybody together in a design charrette? And then what are the implications of that at the end when that building or that facility is now open and operational, and the impact it has for our national defense and frankly, for protecting what we value so highly in terms of our freedom. This is one of those podcasts where I feel like we could go on for 3 or 4 hours. We're going to have you back, and we'll get into a few other specifics around your approach, and maybe as a follow-on to that important work you're going to be doing in St. Louis. But before we go and close out, I'd like to do what I always do in these podcasts, and that is ask you a few rapid-fire questions, a little more to pull out. Who's Rich Stump? What's he thinking about? He's been all over the world and across 6 continents and 39 countries. You know, at RSNH, we have a thing in our essence that is termed driven to care. And you've sort of exhibited many aspects of that through some of your examples today. But I really want to ask you personally, when you hear driven to care, what do you think of?
In my role as an officer of the company, as someone who is at a point in my career where I get a significant amount of satisfaction personally, professionally, helping set up teams for success and finding solutions to really challenging problems. Being driven to care is about intentionality. It's about desiring to bring your best self to whatever it is you're working on at any given time. If you don't care about what you're doing, then you really need to go have a good hard look in the mirror. Because you might not be doing you're not doing your highest and best work. So being driven to care is, you know, working on behalf of our customers, working within a team collaboratively, and delivering a quality outcome, whatever that outcome may be, that solution may be, and basically bringing your best self to whatever you're working on at any given time.
I appreciate that view, and a view that's backed up by your own work and the work that your team has done. You know, in this environment that we live in and your experiences across the world, you know, we have all kinds of challenges professionally, but personally, we've seen our mental health and wellness as being critical issues that we face in the workplace. And it used to be something we wouldn't talk about, and now we do. And it's important that we do talk about it. What's the one thing or two things that you do to support your own mental health and wellness?
We can have a whole podcast conversation about that, Brian, in all honesty. One of the things, it's interesting how things that you do early in your life end up coming back full circle later on. So when I was in the military and I realized I was going to start deploying places, I said, you know what? I need to have a skill of something that I can do that's portable, because I don't know where I'm going to be at any given day. So I actually, when I was living in Montana and I was stationed in Montana, I started learning Tai Chi. Because all I needed was a 3 by 3 foot square. If I had that much space, I could practice Tai Chi. And over the years, that Tai Chi practice has grown and morphed into a wide variety of things. So for example, I meditate every day. That is the first thing I do when I get up in the morning. 30 minutes, mandatory. no questions. I mean, I'm up to 887 consecutive days in a row. And that streak, as long as I am breathing on this planet and I can get myself out of bed in the morning, I'm going to keep doing it. I also have a pretty robust Qigong practice. Doing energy work. So there's a teacher here in Chicago in the Loop that runs a number of courses. I go down there every Saturday morning in person and participate in that. But even more to that point, so let me take this and say, so what do I do for mental health? One of the things that I guess I had a bit of an epiphany at the end of last year, and I'm working towards it this year. So I had this idea that every aspect of our life is interrelated. And I think we all kind of know that intuitively, but we don't ever really state it. So this year I am working, and I've kind of conceived of my life as being in four buckets. So there's physical health, mental health, spiritual health, social health. So I am working on a trajectory to try to get myself by December 31st to being in the best shape of my life in each of those four buckets. And nice. In order to do that, I'm actually doing basically like a quarterly retreat, a personal professional retreat. And I'm kind of like, breaking down my approach. And so every month I sit down and look back at, okay, set the goals for the month. Did I achieve the goals for the month? If I did, where am I going next? And one of the things that I guess I've just kind of learned that consistency is really key. And showing up and moving the needle just a little bit every day. You do that, I'm going to start like quoting Jim Quick for a minute. You move the needle 1% a day. Guess what? In a year, you've moved the needle 17 times from where you based. So it's a very long, so I've given you a very long-winded, slightly convoluted answer to your question. What do I do for mental health? Well, it's a wide variety of things, but I consider it's part and parcel of just being. And if there's that one thing that I'm going to do, it's meditate, because it gets the day started correctly. It keeps me grounded. And basically anything I can do to keep my stress level down is a win. And I've found that meditation is an incredibly effective way to do that.
I appreciate you sharing that with our listeners. And we've had a wide variety of individuals on this podcast who approach it, mental health and wellness, from different perspectives. And many have talked about meditation or exercise or consistency. And it's the old adage, you may feel like, oh my gosh, I can't read two books. But if you start with a page, all of a sudden you can get to that book and read it. And so really appreciate that viewpoint. And the final question I want to ask you personally, it's what is the best piece of professional advice that you've ever received?
I'm going to take that question and I'm going to twist it a little bit, and I'm going to basically take it in terms of something that I've internalized that I've learned over time. And it's funny because it's actually, I'm going to bring this all the way back, Brian, to what we started talking about, which was facilitating charrettes.
Good.
So there is a book called The Four Agreements. It was written by a guy named Don Miguel Ruiz, and you may or may not be familiar with it. I got onto that book a few years ago, and I was looking for something that was going to help me with just kind of structuring things in my personal life. And the four agreements are pretty straightforward, but are incredibly profound as you peel back the layers. So the four agreements are: be impeccable with your word, don't take things personally, don't make assumptions, always do your best. And I started working those things in my personal life. And I said, wow, these work pretty well. So then last year, I started using them at RSNH. I started using them professionally. And I actually have a poster near my desk in my office. And there, I can't tell you how many times I have picked that poster up and I've like stuck it in the camera and said, you see these four things? and we talk about them. And actually, when I work with the, my direct reports in the San Antonio studio, everybody knows. I mean, like, hey, these are the four things you can expect from me. And if I don't do, if I do something that's out of bounds, that, you know, kind of violates these four, I really would like you to tell me about it. So then I'm finding, all right, well, this is really working well in work. I mean, I'm getting a lot of positive reaction. People say, yeah, okay. I mean, they can sign up for these things and we could go have a long conversation about architects and engineers and how challenging it is to not make assumptions and not take things personally because we take so much pride in what we do. But now then I said, you know, I was thinking about this in the fall, you know what? I could probably use this in a design charrette because one of the things, again, going back to being a pilot, going back to taking things, you know, getting things level set and lifted off properly. So I've started in some of my, in my charrette saying, okay, here are some rules that we're going to try to follow. And I actually just did this last week in Naples, Italy, facilitating an industry government engagement session. So I said, all right, you know, we're going to, you know, in addition to using Chatham House rules in terms of the conversations we had, I said, okay, can everybody agree that you're going to be impeccable with your word? You're say what you mean. If you say something's incorrect, you apologize, you move on, and, you know, don't use hearsay and gossip. Can everybody agree not to make assumptions? If you don't understand something, ask. You know, don't assume somebody said what you thought they said because they may not have. So you've got to be curious and ask thoughtful questions. Don't take things personally because anything that anybody says or does is never about you. It's always about the person who did it. And then, of course, doing your best has to do with it. Even over the course of a day, my best in the morning and my best in the evening are two different things. So at least when you get everybody into the room, can you stay focused? Can you be present and thoughtful and attentive and do your best? And I found it really works. So you're going to hear about that if you make it to St. Louis and you get a chance to listen to my presentation here on the 17th of April.
Well, Rich, your four agreements, you've lived up to them today. And I appreciate you doing that for the AEC Perspectives podcast. It's been my great honor to have one of our RSNH vice presidents, Rich Stump, a design charrette expert and a creative expert. And he has brought his best to this podcast. Rich, thanks so much for being with me. And to all those out there listening to AEC Perspectives, please tune in next time for our next episode in our second season. Thanks so much, Rich.
Thank you for having me, Brian. I really enjoyed it.